Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for home theater geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded December 5th, 2011, episode 90, Speaking Truth to Speakers. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Ford, featuring available voice-activated sync. Sync gives you versatile access to music, podcasts, and more from just about any device. Check it out in the new 2012 Ford Focus and at Ford.com/technology. And by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to Netflix.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, online editor of HomeTheater.com. This week's guest geek is Kevin Vakes, manager of product development for Harman's Luxury Audio Group, which includes Revel speakers, JBL Synthesis products, Lexicon products, and Mark Levinson electronics. And he's also a premier speaker designer with many, many years in that field. So we're going to be focusing today on speakers. Hey, Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Scott. I really appreciate coming back.
Well, it's always great to have you on because speakers are a great topic to talk about. Everybody needs them, and few people really understand them. So I'd like to spend some time today talking about a variety of topics in terms of speakers that we can hopefully help people get the most out of what they have.
Wonderful. That sounds great. People always have lots of questions and maybe even things they didn't know they should have been asking.
Exactly. So those who are tuned into the live video stream at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Kevin, and I'll pass along as many as I can during the show. So, Kevin, you and I had lunch last week, and that's really why I wanted to have you on, because we had a great discussion about a variety of topics. And I wanted to start with the whole concept of speakers in a box. You know, most speakers come in some sort of enclosure. And we were talking about whether or not the shape of that enclosure greatly affects the sound. And so I wanted to start with that, and in particular with the question, there's not only box speakers, but also electrostatic or magnaplanar speakers, which have no box. And so they radiate sound forward and backward simultaneously. So what are the basic advantages and disadvantages of each of these two approaches?
Well, that's really numerous issues. One of them is the... One of them is the box question, and we often hear claims made about boxes that are non-box shaped and how that's very important for the standing waves inside the box and to reduce resonances.
Right. They have curved sides.
Exactly. And we make such speakers, but we're very, very cautious about making any claims, even if they would be to our good, that we can't back up with real science. And so that's an example of a case where making the curve back loudspeaker can have the advantage that it can be inherently stronger. But in reality...
You mean physically?
Yes. But in reality, unless a loudspeaker enclosure is a very extreme shape, like a very long pipe, where you would indeed have resonance problems, you don't have such problems. And especially the curve shape is along the sides rather than the top and bottom in everything, really. So it's not really solving those problems. However,
the manufacturers claim it's solving.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of audio folklore, as you know, and that's one of their little points. The shape of the baffle is a really big deal because
and the baffle just to make sure everybody understands, the baffle is the front surface of the speaker, right?
Exactly. And if it's flat and has sharp corners, like most all loudspeakers, then you end up with diffraction problems. And diffraction is where the sound that travels along the surface is repropagated at that diffraction point. And so it results in poorer, rougher on-axis response. And probably an even greater problem is that it really, really degrades the off-axis response or responses at various angles. And as you know, we've done a lot of research into what's important and what isn't, and we learned that the first reflections from sidewalls are really, really important. Those first reflections are delayed so little in time and attenuated so little in level that our ear-brain mechanism hears them as all the same event as what's literally the direct sound from the loudspeaker. So we need to pay a lot of attention even to that far off-axis response. And good freedom from diffraction goes a long, long, long way towards improving that far off-axis response.
And one way to improve the or to increase the freedom from diffraction, as you say, is to make the edges of the baffle of the front surface of the speaker curved rather than sharp corners.
Exactly. And the degree of curve that's required depends on the width of the baffle to begin with. So that all has to be calculated and tested. But it does make a big difference. Now, that's, of course, a completely different issue than the question of enclosed type or direct radiator loudspeakers versus loudspeakers that are either an open type, like most electrostats, or, as you mentioned, magnaplaners, or can also be enclosed where you have discrete transducers on the rear operating either in phase for bipoles or out of phase for dipoles.
Well, that's true. Some speakers, box enclosed speakers, do have drivers on the back.
That's right. I made one of those many years ago at a previous company, recognizing that a dipole configuration was in many ways the worst of all worlds, because you had interference or cancellation from the front to the back that would limit how far down the speaker was useful.
How far down in frequency, you mean?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
And either a dipole or a bipole front loudspeaker configuration is meant to intentionally create a change. I'm avoiding using the word enhance because sometimes it would, sometimes it wouldn't, to create a change in the sound field in the stage. Indeed, they will do that, but you know, I feel that first of all, that's clearly only a two-channel issue. We know that we can't really record or reproduce an event really faithfully with just two channels, that the dimension of space isn't there to the degree that it should be. Mm-hmm. So dipolar and bipolar loudspeakers have been around a long, long time and would give you a bigger sense of that space. Unfortunately, it's not something that's switchable like you could do, or adjustable like you could do with a multi-channel system. Instead, you always have this artifact, it must be said to be honest, that you've introduced that will have its imprint on everything, whether it is desirable or not. So I believe that the more faithful approach in reproducing the signal is to have a front-firing loudspeaker. Mm-hmm. And then if the user chooses to enhance that with an upmixing technology and additional surround loudspeakers, they can do that. But they can do that then with the ability to turn it off for small, you know, more intimate kinds of recordings, for example, or to adjust those parameters to suit different recordings, since it's hard to have one size fits all in those kinds of enhancements, and it's impossible if you do that mechanically with the front loudspeakers.
Right. Got a question in the chat room already about ports. Now we haven't talked yet about ported boxes versus sealed boxes, but Beatmaster in the chat room asks about what about the surface of the ports, the rear opening? Sometimes ports are in the front as well for bass. Some brands do they cover this, or they have a surface on these ports that looks kind of like a golf ball with a bunch of little dimples. Does that make a difference?
That's a really minuscule thing. Whereas the important aspects of ports, no pun intended, is that you have as large a diameter as you can accommodate in the system, that you have the right kind of flare, and that flare is plural, that you have a matching flare on the inside and outside, which often isn't the case since you can't see the one on the inside. But it,
yeah, so you really don't know.
Exactly. But there'll be spurious noises added if you don't have the flares on both ends. We use fluid modeling techniques in order to look at what the ports are going to do, and we can actually look at when noises would be generated or when there is port compression. If the port isn't large enough relative to the surface area of the transducers, you know, the air that they're moving, then you can have compression issues. So we model that and then test the models to make sure that they're accurate as part of the design process.
So this golf ball dimpling thing is really insignificant.
Pretty insignificant. I would put it, you know, a hundredth down on a list of significant things.
All right. Explain to us, please, the whole idea of porting a loudspeaker. You've been talking a little bit about how you design the ports to behave a certain way and not create noise and so on, versus a sealed, completely sealed box. What advantages and disadvantages do you have for each of those approaches, which I assume, you know, it's a balancing act in both cases?
Sure. The one advantage to a sealed box, well, okay, let's say there's two. One is they're much, much, much easier to design successfully than a bass reflex or ported system. So that means that there are more good examples in the marketplace of sealed box loudspeakers, which has helped lead to a poor reputation for bass reflex loudspeakers, because there have been a lot of inadequate engineering attempts at doing the bass reflex loudspeakers. At the same time, bass reflex loudspeakers work properly with woofers that have a lower Q to begin with.
And which, Q, let's define that for everybody before we move on.
Well, it's a combination of characteristics that the significant part for this discussion is they're related to the motor system and the combined strength of the motor system. So how much voice coil there is in the gap, the magnetic strength of the gap, the design of the magnetic system, and lower Q transducers are those, generally speaking, with bigger motors. And they're not as suitable for a sealed box loudspeakers. Sealed box loudspeakers, you want a system Q of about 0.7, and depending on the size of the box, pretty high Q of the woofer. And so that means either a smaller motor system or higher mass, either leading to lower sensitivity or efficiency, as it's usually said. Mm-hmm. And so the overall loudspeaker ends up being lower sensitivity. And of course, with low frequency characteristics in loudspeakers, it's a real trade-off between sensitivity, box size, and low frequency extension. Mm-hmm. With a properly designed bass reflex system, you can achieve higher sensitivity because they want lower Q transducers, which have bigger motors and higher sensitivity to begin with. So, you know, I see that as a big advantage. Now, it is true that bass reflex loudspeakers roll off more quickly than sealed box loudspeakers. So that's why to do a really valid comparison of how they'll sound, you need to look at the minus 10 dB low frequency point rather than the minus 3 dB low frequency point, which isn't going to really illustrate that, that one of them has rolled off faster than the other. So we do it the honest way, but we feel that for most applications, there's just an overwhelming argument for bass reflex systems.
Now, Tao in the chat room is saying that there's a problem if the ports are too big. Is that true? I mean, you said before that you want them as big as possible, but can they be too big?
Well, generally speaking, you want them as big as possible to reduce port noise and to reduce compression. But you can't just make a port bigger without lots of implications. If it's bigger, it has to be longer, and you're going to have an ideal tuning frequency for the entire system. And so one really great luxury that we have is to be able to design everything from scratch. And it's one of the reasons that there are all these poor examples of bass reflex loudspeakers where transducers that are off the shelf just didn't have really optimum characteristics for a particular application. But when you do it in a kind of holistic manner where everything can be designed for the application, you don't have to settle for almost the ideal characteristics. They can be ideal. So I can't think of an instance where you could literally have a port diameter that was too large, assuming that that was appropriate for that application.
Mm-hmm. And somebody in the chat room, Mixer says, biggest port possible is an open box. And that gets us back to electrostats, which have no port, no box, nothing, which then present another set of challenges. One of which I think, if correct me if I'm wrong, is that they have that their placement in the room is pretty critical, more critical than a box speaker.
Sure, it's considerably more critical because you are utilizing that output from the rear of the loudspeaker that's facing the front wall of your room. Mm-hmm. And it's that reflection that's giving you a bigger, deeper sense of a soundstage. So, that means that it's going to be more critical. And for low frequency reinforcements, that's usually a challenge with planar type loudspeakers in general, mm-hmm. unless you use separate subwoofers.
Go ahead.
Well, I would say it's not to say that you can place a sealed box loudspeaker or a direct radiating loudspeaker just anywhere you want it.
No, that's true too.
You know, you've got the twin low frequency issues to deal with of how it's sitting within the standing waves. Standing wave pattern in the room, and speaker boundary interference, or the interference from a nearby wall or walls, to consider, and where you'll get a dip in the response and then a rise below that. And everybody that's played with audio at all has experienced that effect when they put loudspeakers closer to a wall
to get more bass.
Right. Exactly.
And certainly where we generally put subwoofers, you can put them against a wall and increase the bass. You can put them in the corner and increase the bass even more.
Exactly. And the case for subwoofers is considerably different than the case for a full-range loudspeaker. Mm-hmm. First of all, with a full-range loudspeaker, you have to worry about all the rest of the frequency range. And so where the room and room placement is dominant, which is below everything around 300 or 400 hertz, is all about room modes and the room interaction. Mm-hmm. So it means that you need to worry about that entire frequency range from 20 hertz to 400 hertz with the placement of your main loudspeakers, whereas with a subwoofer, you need only worry about 80 hertz and on down, typically. Mm-hmm. So you know, that's certainly an advantage subwoofer there. The other thing is that with a full-range loudspeaker, you, of course, have to greatly consider the placement for imaging, which is critical with any technology loudspeaker for front speakers. So those are sometimes at odds with each other, complicating the location or the ideal placement of any loudspeaker, as well as, it should be said, your listening position, because it can be thought of as kind of a transfer function where all we care about is how it sounds at the listening or listening positions from signals that are generated, sound that's generated by the loudspeakers. We don't have to worry about what you could hear if there was a loudspeaker somewhere else, which is part of the fallacy of people walking through a room and clapping their hands and saying, oh, no. they do it all the time. But unless they're clapping their hands in the positions of the loudspeakers, it's completely irrelevant.
Mm. But of course, they do that, they're in the position of the loudspeaker too, not in the listening position, unless they have a partner, somebody else.
Absolutely.
At the listening position, yeah.
It takes two people to do that.
Right, exactly. Wise Warrior in the chat room is wondering about padding on the walls. We're talking about first reflections being so important. And he brings up a great point, which is acoustic treatment in the room, which is another important factor in optimizing how your speakers are going to perform in a room.
Well, yes, it is. And it is it's an area where there are a lot of different opinions and well-advised opinions that differ. So you can look at Dr. Floyd Toole, who really is, you know, the dean of loudspeakers, and it's probably the only area where we disagree about loudspeakers, because it's a matter of personal taste in the outcome. If you prefer a bigger sound stage, a more spacious sound all the time, then you will tolerate or maybe embrace that first reflection. You can also use a diffuser at the first sidewall reflection points. The only problem that I find with that is that there's no diffuser that's 100% efficient. They'll still be enough output at the listening position from that reflection off of the diffuser to reduce the specificity, you know, the pinpoint magic of stereo imaging versus or as compared to absorbing as much of that signal as possible. It's certainly true that no absorber is a black hole, and it's a bad idea to put thin absorption over a large area in particular, because it's not going to work for a very wide frequency range. So if someone's going to absorb that first sidewall reflection, I would encourage them to do it effectively. So it doesn't have to cost money. It can be 4 inches of fiberglass. It's just great. Mm. And of course, your viewers and listeners are probably familiar with the so-called mirror trick. Because our eyes are conveniently located so close to our ears, if you have two people, you can just move the mirror while someone is seated or moving among the listening positions, looking for the tweeter and mid-range of both the adjacent speaker and the opposite side speaker.
You want to be able to see both of those in the mirror.
Well, those will be two separate points, of course, those are your first reflection points on that surface.
And that's where you want to put 4 inches of fiberglass or some sort of absorber.
Well, particularly if it's close to the speakers, the distance to that first reflection is very important. If your side walls are far away, I wouldn't worry about it. Mm. Another thing, and in most people's rooms, their sidewalls are not terribly far away from their loudspeakers, unless you just have a humongous room. Also, it's important to have those first reflection points as equal as possible. And a lot of people say, well, one side of the room is completely open to another area that's large. Well, then I would use something that's really absorptive on the opposite wall to try to compensate for that, because stereo imaging is all about getting the same thing from both speakers, and we have to consider the inconvenient fact that first reflection is part of what we hear as the direct sound from the loudspeaker.
Mm. Mm. Inconvenient though it may be, for geeks like us, it's really important.
Oh, absolutely.
This is all great advice, and I'm really, really happy to be talking about it. Let's take a moment, though, before we continue, to thank one of our sponsors for this episode, which is Netflix. Netflix, of course, as we all know, home theater geeks typically know, streams thousands of TV shows and movies directly to your TV or your computer, from your Xbox or gaming console, from your Blu-ray player, from the TV itself. You can use your computer as a source and put it on your TV. It's available just about everywhere, and it eliminates time, money, and hassle with discs, certainly, by just streaming things directly into your home over the internet. I've been using it lately, as I've said in the past, to watch Deep Space Nine, my favorite Star Trek series, and it's been very, very convenient for that. As I said, your gaming console, they've got special boxes, a Roku box, the Boxy box. They'll all bring Netflix into your home, as well as Blu-ray players and TVs and just about everything else, which you can watch instantly. Don't have to wait for the mail on that. You can even begin watching on one device and end on another. So total flexibility there. Whichever way you choose to use it, you can watch as many movies as you want, and TV shows for that matter, for one low monthly subscription. For TWIT listeners and viewers, Netflix is offering a free 30-day trial. All you have to do is go to netflix.com/twit. Be sure to use that URL, netflix.com/twit, for your 30-day free trial. And we thank Netflix for their support of the TWIT network. So, Kevin, SoCal Ray in the chat room, one of our good buddies, has asked, does Harman have a site at which there are white papers or technical information available to the general public about the things we've been speaking about?
There are links on the main Harman site, and we have new sites for our four brands, which are currently getting completely populated, and we will add those. I see that it says marklevinson.com. There's also rebelspeakers.com. There's lexicon.com and jblsynthesis.com for our four brands. Also, Dr. Olive, Sean Olive, who is the head of our research department, has a really great blog that now includes, I wanted to point out, because this is very cool, our listener training software, which had previously been available only for our own employees, but now is available to the world on his site.
Well, that's very cool.
Yeah, our dealers and distributors had asked for it for years, so I'm glad that it's now available.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. And where is that again?
Well, the page disappeared. I will tell you in a moment.
Okay, very good. Meanwhile, got a bunch of questions in the chat room. I'll ask you here. Let's see. For absorption, Christopher says, for absorption, bass traps in the corners. Does that seem to work for you?
I haven't found bass traps in the corners to be particularly effective. When you look, the corners are where you have maximum pressure or against a boundary, but not maximum velocity where they would work most effectively. And I'm assuming that he's talking about something like tube traps, as opposed to a tuned resonant device, which those are very effective. And they can also be used for a neat trick that isn't immediately obvious, and this is one of Dr. Toole's ideas, at least I learned it first from him. Very often you'll have a listening position or positions that are in unfortunate modal locations. Mm-hmm. And typically side to side is a problem there because you want to be centered in the room for all sorts of other reasons.
Right, but the center of the room is actually not a great place for modal reasons.
Right, but you can move any nasty modes out of the way, essentially, if it's a side-to-side mode, just by using a tuned resonant device to the side on either of the side walls, to the side of that location, and effectively move that mode. So we can't think just in terms of measured dimensions for where these modes occur, because differences in construction, which almost always exist, even if you've tried really hard to make it the same, are going to mean that the actual acoustic points are not quite where the physical points are.
That's an interesting point. I had never considered that before.
Yeah, they're pretty far off in most rooms. If it wasn't a dedicated theater that was built, you know, using real caution, in most rooms they're way far off. And so the easiest way to determine them is just with simple measurements, high resolution measurements.
Right,
that could be done so inexpensively these days.
Well, here's a somewhat unrelated subject question, but I want to get to it before we run out of time and before this question vanishes off the off the top of my chat room screen, which is from Kiki, who asks, when will the new Lexicon MP20 surround processor be available? And will there be a trade-in program for previous Lexicon customers?
I'm glad you're asking that message, Kiki. It will be available later next year. I don't know the exact time yet. But I really believe it will be well worth waiting for, and I know the wait has been considerable. But there's really pretty sensational technology being introduced in the MP20 for the first time in any product. So it'll be worth it. Quantum logic surround is the really, really exciting thing.
Which we were going to talk about. I wanted to talk about on this show, so I guess that's a good enough lead in as any.
there you go. And while I at this point won't get into the super details, it's a completely different approach towards upmixing, as we call it, where you are increasing the number of channels. So typically that's from 2 to 5.1, 5.4. 7.4, but then we're using quantum logic surround 3D, the next level of the mixing process, to add 5 height channels. And the effect is really extremely impressive and not gimmicky. That's one of the things that we all wanted to avoid. We don't want to disrespect artists that have, you know, spent their lives creating fantastic work, and we've been very cautious to avoid tampering in any sort of negative way with their art. So it will take two channel signals and increase them to the number of channels that you have in your system in an adjustable manner, and not extracting the additional channels in the conventional way, which have usually looked at phase differences and such. Rather than that, it extracts time or spatial slices, I'm sorry, spatial slices from the front soundstage in the case of two channels, and can relocate those signals to the sides, to the rear, even up above. The fascinating thing to me is that if you do that process, so you've got an input signal, you're then doing this processing as extreme as I'm saying, where you're moving the reverberant decay to the back and or above you, but then you can sum all of this back together. And if you compare that output signal to the input signal, you'll see that it's bit accurate. So that's really revolutionary in itself.
In other words, you haven't actually changed any of the data that's come in.
We've rearranged it. We haven't changed it. Now, you can go a layer above that processing in which you would potentially make it not bit accurate. For example, if you're upmixing 5.1, 6.1, 7.1 to add the full five height channels, and we always recommend four subwoofers with our sound field management, of course, you then could have situations where it's not bit accurate, but where you have pretty spectacular results. There is an algorithm that's part of it that actually detects things like rain and will make it rain from above. Flyover effects that literally fly over. It has to be heard to be believed.
Now, you may not know the answer to this, but the second part of Kiki's question was, will current Lexicon owners, presumably of the MC-12, which is the current pre-pro, be given any sort of trade-in allowance or accommodation, or is this a whole new ballgame?
I actually don't know the answer to that for sure.
Okay.
But it will certainly be announced, and maybe as early as CES.
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to seeing you there at CES and hearing the system. I unfortunately was unable to hear it at Cedia last September, but that makes it all the more important for me to come visit you at the Venetian at CES in January. So you will see me there, I'm sure.
Wonderful. We won't actually be demonstrating quantum logic surround.
No.
At the show, we'll have some surprising new announcements from several of our brands.
Good. Well, I'll come over to that for that anyway, and maybe I can come over to Harman at some point and hear the quantum logic.
Sure, and we even hired Nathaniel Kunkel, who is a brilliant mixer recording engineer who's got an amazing discography, to help us assure that we weren't stepping on the artist's intentions. And he's one of the things he's renowned for is upmixing recordings to multi-channel. And we wanted to make sure that it could be done automatically in a manner that you could say, wow, whoever did that as a professional did a great job, except it's automatic in your MP20 in the Lexicon. So we're at that stage of results.
I'm very interested to hear also, there are other systems that do what you're talking about, upmixing. There's a DTS Neo X, there's Odyssey DSX, Dolby ProLogic 2Z, will all do this same thing. And in a way, you're entering this the field a little late, it seems to me. So presumably, you've got something to offer that that they don't.
Well, we've been in the field a long time with our Logic 7.
Oh, that's true. You're right. Thank you for the correction. That's exactly right. You have been in the field a long time.
And that's been widely praised as a superior system.
But true enough.
Now it's apples to oranges in results. It's really amazing. And of course, there's the whole height dimension, and we found this to be really superior to what's out there so far for height. And you know, given that it works in an entirely different manner, it's not just a question of degrees or tweaking. It's a whole different thing.
Whole different ball of wax, as they say.
Exactly.
Hopefully not in your ears. Well, you mentioned height channels, and I wanted to get to that a little bit. But before we do, I do have one other sponsor for the show I'd like to thank. So if you'll just give me a moment, I would like to thank the other sponsor for our show, which is Ford, featuring Available Sync. The Sync Entertainment features, in this case, access music and podcasts. Of course, you'd want to access Home Theater Geeks from your Ford Sync, I'm sure. and these podcasts and music and so on can be on just about any device, including iPods, smartphones, tablets, flash drives even. And with Sync, with My Ford Touch, you can play videos or display photos from your digital camera or portable game device when your vehicle is in park, of course. It's all made possible by a versatile media hub, which supports a convenient variety of devices for your music and entertainment, such as wired connections through USB port, SD slot, RCA jacks, wireless access via Bluetooth, that is with Bluetooth-enabled devices, of course. all you have to do is connect your devices and play. Once your device is connected, you can use Sync voice activation to play what you want, like, for example, play genre, rock, or play artist, or play track, or song title. It's very convenient, and of course, it keeps your hands on the road, and your hands on the wheel, and your eyes on the road. also available with Sync with My Ford Touch is HD Radio, which features iTunes tagging that lets you tag a song you like. Very, very cool. Transfer this info to your iPod and purchase the song directly from iTunes. Sounds good to me. The versatile entertainment features of Sync with My Ford Touch are available on the 2012 Ford Focus. You can learn more about it at ford.com/technology. So we were about to talk about height speakers, and this is a big deal these days. Not only having five speakers around you, plus a subwoofer or two or four, but also speakers above you. And typically they're in front of you and above. You were talking, I think you kind of implied that you might want to have more than that above you, ideally. Did I get you right on that?
Well, more than two, more than three, absolutely. Five is a really ideal number to have above you and you know, not hard to achieve, particularly if you use in-ceiling loudspeakers. I probably should, since I found it, people are still wondering, how do I get that software from Sean? It's Sean Olive, that's S-E-A-N, Olive, .blogspot.com.
Oh, great. And he blogs there as well as providing the listener training software.
Exactly. And it's not indoctrination software. it's not in any way brand specific. It is actually to train you to be able to identify what frequencies you're hearing something in, whether it's a resonance, which we know are important problems, whether it's just an amplitude response problem. So it changes you from saying, well, that sounds blurry, to, sounds to me like there's a dip that's an octave and a half wide centered at 2 kilohertz. a more useful answer.
A much more useful answer.
Yeah, they have a lot of fun with it, and it really helps in your ability to get your system working well.
Mm-hmm. I have seen this, at least the version that I saw a couple of years ago at Harman. Was very, very interesting. Basically a training program that you run on the computer, and it teaches you how to listen to these for these particular frequencies and widths and so on. So it's very useful. I would suggest anyone interested in becoming a more educated listener take that class or that course, I should say, on the computer. And I'm so glad that Harman is now offering it to everyone. That's really great news.
It's always amazed me that we give away all this stuff, especially all the published papers that of roadmaps. But at any rate, I interrupted where we were talking about the height speakers. And
yes.
We're currently doing research into precisely the optimum locations for these loudspeakers. You know, that's the most exciting thing about working for Harman for me is that it's the audio company that has the resources and the will to do real research. And so we'll find out, you know, including all the psychoacoustic aspects, exactly what those optimum locations are. Mm-hmm. We've been getting an amazing number of questions, inquiries from people saying, okay, but I'm putting in my theater now, what's the answer? So for anybody that is doing that, I can give you our best answer at this point in time, which is that you want the center height speaker, of course, above the center loudspeaker. That's the only easy one. The left and right surround or ceiling height surrounds should be between, let's look at the left channel as an illustration.
Sure.
On a line between the left front channel and the left surround channel. I was going to start by assuming,
oh, well, you should just put the height speakers above where their counterparts are, you know, down on the floor. And that was correct, according to you, for the center speaker, but not for the other height speakers.
Right, because it also enhances the width. And so it's more effective if it is not at the same location. So anyone can envision in their room where that would then be located, and it would be a little wider than your front loudspeakers.
I see.
Then the rear channels would similarly be located between the rear, if you have a 7.x configuration, between the rear, in this case, left loudspeaker and the side surround left mm-hmm. loudspeaker. And in many of our installations, there are multiple side surrounds. So
as there are in commercial cinemas.
Yeah. To accommodate larger rooms. So
right.
In each of these cases, the front height or the rear height, it would be on a line between the nearest side surround mm-hmm. and the front or rear loudspeakers.
So what we're really talking about here is essentially 10.x or 12.x system with a 5.1 or a 7.1 on the floor on the listener's level, and then five extra speakers above.
Right, 12.4 typically.
Mm-hmm.
You know our research into the optimum number of subwoofers showed that four placed either on the midpoints, the acoustic midpoints of the sidewalls,
yep.
or the corners are best. And our default placement is the corners because that gives you that added gain of another boundary. And with subwoofers, usually the biggest challenge is getting enough undistorted, uncompressed, mm-hmm. not just undistorted, output. So the coroners win there. And of course, in that we've always learned in the ancient past that was the exact worst place to put a subwoofer.
Right.
But that was before equalization.
Right.
And indeed, you stimulate every room mode by design if you put the subwoofers in the corner. But reducing peaks is absolutely trivial. And then you have the maximum output. So that's the reason for the four corners. And if you use speakers or subwoofers in the four corners, you drastically reduce the seat-to-seat variation, which is one of the biggest single problems that exists in home theater audio. We know that you can go from one row to another in rooms and see 10, 15, even 20 dB differences at low frequencies.
Yeah.
Well, it is by definition impossible to equalize that room other than for one single seat. And almost nobody uses just one seat in a home theater. So
right.
It means that your first job is to make them all similar at low frequencies. And just by placing the four subwoofers in the corners, you've gone a long, long way towards doing that, no matter whose subwoofers they are. You can then take the next step, which we call sound field management, where we're electronically manipulating all of the subwoofers relative to each other and to all the main channels in a non-intuitive manner that only a computer would come up with. To further reduce the seat-to-seat variation, and you know that's in the MP20, eagerly awaiting.
Yes, indeed. Well, we only have a couple minutes left, and I just wanted to briefly touch. Unfortunately, we don't have enough time to really get into it. But when we're talking about height speakers, we were talking about putting them as either in ceiling or on ceiling. Which may be, correct me if I'm wrong, one of the few applications of in-ceiling or on-ceiling speakers that you would actually enjoy or think performed well. Because there are some basic limitations to putting speakers in a wall or a ceiling or even on the wall or ceiling.
There are. And in this case, there are potential advantages to the in-ceiling approach. But the problem there is that most in-ceiling loudspeakers are designed essentially for on-axis applications. And if you look at the locations of these five height channels, none of them are on-axis. So using a conventional in-ceiling loudspeaker would be a bad idea because the response way, way off-axis, which you would always be, would be pretty rough from anybody's speaker. So you need something that is intentionally designed to be used far off axis. And a number of manufacturers make those. We just introduced 21 architectural or in-wall in-ceiling loudspeakers, and I can say that I have been unhappy, to put it mildly, with the results that manufacturers have been getting by trying to make the in-ceiling speakers work off-axis, because they introduced typically really bad resonances by having a woofer there that's a cavity, and by creating really bad diffraction, especially if they're adjustable. So we have a solution product that works really well for that. It's a fixed angle with flat diaphragm woofers to eliminate that resonance issue. That's the best approach I currently know of for height channels. With on ceiling or flush mount type loudspeakers, or surface mount, I should say.
Yeah.
No matter who the manufacturer is, you always have an issue that there's going to be an irregularity in the response due to that nearby reflection. And it's at a much higher frequency than you typically get when you're putting your main speaker closer to a wall to try to get some more low frequency output.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it can't be equalized out with even our best equalizers because it's angle dependent. So that's that's a vote for the actual in-ceiling application where there's no such reflection. So these architectural speakers have the advantage, whether they're in-wall or in-ceiling, of not having that reflection problem of where there's angular-dependent interference. Mm-hmm. And that's a very, very big deal.
Well, I wish we had more time to talk about it. Unfortunately, we are out of time, and there's even many more topics that I had on my list that we didn't even get to. So will you come back and be on the show again?
I'd love to. I was just getting started.
Fantastic. Thanks so much. Kevin Vakes of Harman International, the Harman Luxury Audio Group. You can get his information at harman.com, also revelspeakers.com, lexicon.com, marklevinson.com, and jblsynthesis.com. Am I right about that?
That's perfect. Thank you.
That's it. Okay. You can, of course, find me online at hometheater.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Tyle Hertzens, the editor of our sibling site, Inner Fidelity. He's just conducted a huge headphone face-off called the Celebrity Headphone Death Match. So that's going to be very interesting. He's going to tell us all about the results of that. And so I sure hope you will join us next week. Until then, geek out.